You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 315, Exodus Q&A Part 4. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, well, we lied to everybody, and we were able to squeeze out four episodes. We said two, then we said three, but now we made it four.
Yeah, so. I'll bet they're shocked. I'll bet people are just reeling from that,
A year's worth of questions, so we got to squeeze in as many as we can. But
it's not like it hasn't happened before either.
Right, absolutely. Well, Mike, how's everything else going?
We are up to our necks in students in Jacksonville. So that's a good problem. You know, the distance ed component of the Awakening School started this past Monday. And the final tally, by the time they cut off registration, was a little over 700 just for the distance. So there's about 120 or so live. So we're talking over 800 students, which is significantly more than we thought it would be. But, you know, we'll cope. We will recruit people. Probably we'll drag them kicking and screaming from what their normal job is to help me do some grading. But I can already tell in the fall we're going to have to staff up. So it's a good problem to have.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and have you met any people randomly in town and stuff that have listened to the podcast or read your work or recognized you?
Yes. Okay, so I've been recognized in a grocery store, in a restaurant bathroom, and I'm trying to remember the third place. Oh, yeah, there was a waitress in a restaurant Dreen and I were at that somebody working with her, one of the other waiters, I guess, recognized me and asked her to ask me if it was me.
And then they came over?
So, yeah, like three times in one week.
Hey, that's pretty good.
It was just kind of crazy. Well, I mean, it's Jacksonville, and Celebration is a pretty large, you know, church network here. So I guess I'm not surprised, but that three in a week, that was a bit of a – I wasn't expecting that anyway, especially the one in the restrooms.
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you know if they recognized you because of Celebration or the podcast, or did they say?
One of them was Celebration, and the other two were, you know, they heard me on the podcast or they had read the book or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, that's good stuff. Yeah. I like that. All right, Mike. Well, we got.
Yeah, my kids like to make fun of me when I get recognized like that. They like to pretend that I'm a celebrity or something, especially Simca. She gets into digging me for that, but thankfully she wasn't there for any of them.
Yeah, you're not just famous, you're infamous.
Nerd famous.
Did you ever see that movie, The Three Amigos, with Steve Martin and Chevy Chase?
Oh, a long, long time ago.
Yeah, you know, and they're like, we're infamous. We're not just famous, we're infamous.
We're infamous.
All right, Mike. Well, we've got some questions here, so let's get to it and try to knock them out if we can.
Okay. Sure.
Charlotte really enjoyed the episode on the Kenite hypothesis. In the episode on Exodus 5 and 6, you touched on the translation of Exodus 6, 3. You said it could mean the opposite of how it is translated, implying that God had indeed revealed himself by his name, Yahweh, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. However, in Genesis 32, 24 through 32, Jacob wrestles with God in human form and asks his name. The man refuses. How does this passage relate to the Kenite hypothesis, especially considering the fact that at the time when Jacob wrestled with the man, the Kenites had been around for at least two generations since Abraham and Jacob could therefore have potentially known it? Why does God refuse to give Jacob his name in this instance?
Well, let's briefly review what I said back in episode 266. That was where that's what's being referenced here. I was commenting on Francis Anderson's opinion, which is published in his book, The Sentence in Biblical Hebrew. There's some great late night reading for you. Anderson was commenting that Exodus 6:3 should be translated, "I am the Lord." You know, in other words, "I am Yahweh." I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai, and my name is Yahweh. Did I not make myself known to them? That's quite opposite of what you'll see in most English translations. And, you know, Anderson is doing that based upon his understanding of the syntax in that verse and turning it into a question, which, you know, Anderson is a very famous, very well-known Hebraist and Semiticist. He's not an amateur. And so this could very well be what the point is. And if Anderson is correct, then therefore the verse is no proof of the divine name criterion for JEDP. And again, the documentary hypothesis of the Pentateuch, which takes Yahweh and El names as proof of separate source documents for the Torah. So if Anderson's right, then the divine name criterion, and they reference Exodus 6:3 a lot as justifying the using divine names as a criterion for separate sources. But if he's correct, then that whole argument just sort of falls flat. In the Hebrew Bible as it stands, of course, Yahweh does appear in texts that source critics say originally didn't have the name. They believe, the critics believe, that Yahweh gets sprinkled in the non-Yahweh source or sources by a later editor to help dovetail the sources together and, you know, to help their content create a connection between the patriarchal deity, the El names, El Shaddai, El this, El that, and other sources that use Yahweh. They would say, again, the source critics would say, Abraham didn't know Yahweh as the name of the deity who visited him, but he knew the deity that visited him by some El name. That's how the argument goes. Anyone with a study Bible or, you know, anybody who looks for Lord in all small caps will see the name Yahweh in patriarchal stories and wonder what in the world's going on here. But again, if you wonder what's going on here, then that shows you're not familiar with the whole JEDP approach. That originally the Torah is composed of these source documents. One source document used Yahweh, another source document described the deity in El names, and then some later editor came along and spliced them together and to tighten the agreement, he sprinkled in the divine name in all sorts of places just so it would, you know, it would just cohere more readily. And that's the theory. A source critics, you know, the people with that perspective would say that the Kenites would have been El worshippers, not Yahweh worshippers. And they would have followed the patriarchal traditions, and the patriarchs, of course, in this view, used El names for God. And so they would argue that Exodus 6:3 is new information to Moses and therefore to others in Midian, and even broadly to the Israelites. They would argue that Yahweh is a new name, a special covenant name, forever to be associated with the deliverance from Egypt to which the God of the burning bush was calling Moses. As far as the Jacob incident itself, this is another part of the question, and the refusal of the angel to give a name, the answer could follow a couple trajectories. And I'll just reference there's a decent commentary discussion here. I think Hamilton's commentary, I believe, does a nice job of this. But in a nutshell, there's two ways to look at this. You could say that since the point of the episode, this is Jacob wrestling with the man, again, who turns out to be Elohim, God. Since the point of the episode is that God has decided to change Jacob's name, again, Jacob's name is his given name, is thus surrendered or taken from him. The point could be that Jacob was out of line to ask the angel to surrender his name. After all, Jacob is a trickster in the patriarchal stories, and he could have been seeking information that wasn't relevant to perhaps seek an advantage in the exchange. Now, Currid, we referenced his commentary before in the Exodus series, he thinks that Jacob was essentially playing games at this point to seek an advantage. Currid writes, Jacob then attempts to turn the tables by asking, now tell me your name. The angel of Yahweh responds with another rhetorical question. Jacob already knows with whom he is wrestling. The angel asks, why do you ask my name? Again, implying that Jacob already knows who it is. So the angel isn't letting Jacob call any shots here. He's just refusing. Now, another way to look at this is the ancient belief that to know the name of a supernatural being is to have power over it. You know, some have argued, and it's fairly common in exorcism texts, for example, that this is what's going on. Now, Hamilton, in the New International Commentary on Genesis, he rejects this idea, drawing on a parallel in Judges, the book of Judges, that certainly has no such hint of trying to get power over the supernatural being by asking for the name. So I'm going to read a little bit from Hamilton here, open him up. The man's question, again, if you go back to Judges 13, this is Samson's parents. They get visited by the angel, okay? The man, you know, Samson's mother refers to this figure as a man, okay? So they end up encountering him again, and then they ask the angel, you know, for his name. And so Hamilton writes this. The man's question in response is, "Why is it that you inquire about my name?" It is a question, Hamilton says, to which Jacob is not given the opportunity to respond. And he's, what Hamilton's doing is comparing the two stories. Or perhaps he chooses not to respond. The scene is much like the one between the angel of Yahweh, again, with Jacob, and back to Samson's mother, or father, Manoah. In the Judges story, Manoah said to the angel of Yahweh, "What is your name? So that we may honor you." Now, there's a little, you know, this is me interjecting. Now, there's a little important feature there, because in the Judges story, it's clearly not to seek power or to seek some advantage, you know, over the angel. They're not trying to pull a fast one here. "So what is your name that we may honor you?" And the angel of Yahweh said to him, to Manoah, this is the Judges story, "Why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful?" That's Judges 13, 17 through 18. Both the man, Genesis 32, and the angel in Judges 13 ask the same question. In both instances, the silence, the hesitancy of the other being begins to produce within Jacob or Manoah, depending on the story, a realization of the supernatural status of that being. One wonders if, "Why is it that you inquire about my name?" is another way of asking, "Jacob, don't you realize who I am?" So at this point, Hamilton is sort of veering off to where Currid is at, you know, this, the first view. And he adds, "The text contains no evidence that Jacob desires to know the name of his adversary so that he might exercise power over him. This interpretation is based solely on parallels drawn from primitive religion, in which demons and noumens played a large part. Jacob's question is nothing more than a request for information from and identification of his adversary. This request is a formal element in the theophanies of the Old Testament." He references Judges 13 again there. "A feature of those theophanies seems to be that only with the disappearance of the deity does the protagonist realize he or she has had contact with the divine." And he references Judges 6 along with that, and then Luke 24:31. So, I mean, what's going on here is that both Hamilton and Curd, and I think the comparison with Judges 13 does rule out seeking power by asking the name in this passage. So that leaves us with this option. The refusal, again, in Judges is akin to saying you can't handle the truth, or you ought to know better. You ought to know who I am. And Curd, again, is sort of tracking on the same thing. So I'm with, you know, Curd and Hamilton as far as he's, you know, concurring, you know, with Curd here. The angel doesn't give an answer to Jacob's question, but yet, think about the story. Yet, Jacob calls the name of the place Peniel, the face of God, the face of El, and exclaims, "I have seen God," or a God. "I've seen Elohim face to face." So I think it's reasonable to conclude that Jacob did know. He had some inkling that this wasn't an ordinary man. And so therefore the question again is Jacob playing games and, you know, trying, you know, to seek, you know, something in the exchange that the angel is not willing to give him. But I don't think it's sort of a magical sort of formulation, seeking power over a supernatural being. I think that goes too far.
John has our last question, and it's about episode 266, where Dr. Heiser discussed the biblical motif of the arm of the Lord. I believe he tied it to the Egyptian pharaohs who believed themselves to be Horus incarnate, i.e. Horus in human form. Isaiah 53 clearly speaks of Jesus and states, "And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?" Is it safe for us to view Jesus as the arm of the Lord? Does this give readers a hint that the Messiah, Jesus, would be God in human form?
Well, I think the language in Isaiah 53 certainly points to a personal, an individual deliverer, I don't think readers would intuitively know from the language that God would come as a man, though, as opposed to the passage speaking of a man empowered by God. You know, even in John 12:38, where the Isaiah passage, the Isaiah 53 passage is actually cited, it's actually referenced. Let's just read that back in John. "So that the word spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled, Lord, who has believed what he heard from us, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?" I mean, even in that passage, it's linked, you know, two verses earlier to signs, you know, signs and wonders. So even in John 12:38, the verse is referenced in connection with signs, not as a part of an argument that God had become a man. Though, you know, elsewhere in John, I think some of the things John says make that evident. But in this passage, the citation itself isn't making that point. Now, you know, think about it. Moses was the conduit through which God did signs and wonders, and he wasn't God in human flesh, obviously. If the Messiah was perceived as a new Moses, the prophet like unto Moses, which the New Testament makes pretty obvious, that's how Jesus, you know, was to be perceived, as Acts 3:22, Acts 7:37, for instance, then the arm of the Lord reference could quite easily have been understood in the way that it was used to describe Moses. Here is a human agent of God's power, which falls short of incarnation. So I think it would be to read too much into the language of Isaiah 53 to say that the arm of the Lord points to incarnation. I think that takes the language a bit too far.
Larry in Denver, Colorado has our next question. What or who are the mixed multitude in Exodus 12:38? Are they the same people in Numbers 11:4 when they were referred to as the rabble?
Yeah, this is actually kind of an interesting question. Mixed multitude in Exodus 12:38 is, the Hebrew is erev rav. Rav is a noun that means multitude, and so erev is the important term. And for those who have some Hebrew, this is a homonym to another erev. Erev is a Hebrew word for evening. This is a different Erev. This Erev is used for people of foreign descent, in other words, non-Israelite descent, or not descended from Abraham. Examples would be Nehemiah 13:3. As soon as the people heard the law, they separated from Israel all those of foreign descent. Again, the word there is Erev. Jeremiah 25:20, all the mixed tribes among them. Again, mixed tribes, Erev tribes. Okay. So you get the idea. So the mixed multitude would therefore refer to foreign peoples, i.e. non-Israelites, not non-Hebrews, who left Egypt with the Hebrews. The word translated rabble in Numbers 11:4 is an entirely different word. Okay. And you would think that ought to end the discussion, but it actually doesn't. Some rabbinic commentators do make this identification. They do, you know, view these passages as parallels. Targum Onkelos actually translates the term in Numbers 11:4. Let me just get the terms, because I know I'm going to have to repeat it here. It's Saf Suf. Okay, we have an Aleph appended in the text. This is a weird instance that we're not going to get into, but it's one of the few times in the Hebrew Bible where a letter doesn't have any vocalization for it. So it's pronounced Saf Suf, even though it begins with Aleph. Again, for those of you of Hebrew, you can care about that. For those of you who don't worry about it. But you've got Saf Suf. Let's just say that. So that doesn't sound anything like Erev Rav. But again, you have some rabbinic commentators that view them together. And Targum Onkelos, Targum is an Aramaic translation of something, in this case, the Hebrew Bible, actually translates the Saf Suf term with an Aramaic term that is nearly identical to the Erev Rav in Exodus 12:38. So it's almost like the Aramaic translator, the translator of the Targum, intentionally tried to harmonize the two. And so that gets picked up on by later rabbinic commentary and leads to putting these two things together and identifying the two groups, identifying the mixed multitude of Exodus 12:38 with the rabble of Numbers 11:4. Now, I'm going to read you some real short sections here from some commentators that sort of, you know, they Well, I'll just read them, and you can see where they're coming from here. Bud, this is the word biblical commentary. He writes this. The word occurs. He's talking about Saf Sufna. The word occurs only here and might literally mean a gathering of people from Asaf to collect. Some commentators associate this group with the mixed multitude of Exodus 12:38. The root, however, is different, and there is no clear warrant for that assumption. So that's pretty clear cut in Bud's mind. Now, Baruch Levine, in his commentary on Numbers, writes this. The Hebrew Asaf Suf, so he's going to vocalize the Aleph for us, is a reduplicative form of the verb Asaf, to gather, which is said of taking in foundlings as well as lost objects. Now, see, what he's doing here is he's going to say, okay, if you go back to Exodus 12:38, you'll notice Erev Rav, Erev Rav, Erev Rav, there's that RV or RB actually section of both words. It's like a repetition, Erev Rav. He says, if you look at Numbers 11:4, Asaf Suf is also a reduplication of a particular verb lemma, Asaf, to gather in. He says the verb Asaf, otherwise, you know, can connote, he'll say often connotes, the assembling of fighting forces. Okay, and he's going to draw, you know, a conclusion from that too. So it remains, he says, it remains unclear whether the reference here is to auxiliary fighting forces or to camp followers and other non-Israelite hangers-on. He's basically going to turn this into a mob, is what Levine's doing in his commentary. But anyway, he says, on the parallel account of Exodus 12:38, so he just assumes out of the gate that Exodus 12:38 is parallel, because both forms of the word have this reduplication thing going on in them. He says, in Exodus 12:38, the term used is Erev Rav, perhaps originally a Rav Rav, also a reduplicated form. In both accounts, in Numbers and in Exodus, these presumably non-Israelites are blamed for incurring God's wrath, whereas the fault of the Israelites themselves was that they followed suit. Now, in Exodus 12:38, where's the wrath? So I'm going to object to what Levine's saying here. I think he's reading some things into this. Now, he could say, well, if they were Egyptians, God's wrath was upon them. Well, okay, but if they're leaving, doesn't that suggest whose side they're on? I mean, the Israelites are going to get out of there. The Hebrews are going to be gone, so their problem should be over. If they were really not on the Hebrews' side for some reason, whatever reason, they'd stay. So I just think that he's reading a little bit into this, but it's not a big deal. But that's how the two get identified by some commentators. They'll either, you know, look at the morphology of the terms and say, oh, they're both reduplication forms, so maybe, you know, maybe there's a relationship there, or they'll go and look at the Targum and say, oh, the Targum thought so. Targum translator, you know, tried to harmonize them, so, you know, we should look at it that way too. That's essentially the two trajectories that you get to joining these things. But if you just looked up the lemmas, you're going to see that they're quite different.
All right. Lance has a comment about Exodus 23:19 and 34:26 and Deuteronomy 14:21. Cooking the baby goat in its mother's milk. It seems so left field. What's up?
Yeah, pretty much. It really is, and it's not only that it is to us, but this is one of those passages that will probably never get resolved. I mean, people still wonder about this, but you have, you know, commentators that really, I think, try and you know, they do well to articulate a possibility or two. I'm going to read you what Sarna says here, and then I'll follow that with what Tigay says in the Deuteronomy passage. Sarna writes, this rule, you know, this law, largely remains an enigma. Its importance may be measured by its being repeated twice more in the Torah, Exodus 34:26, Deuteronomy 14:21. In this latter source, the prohibition appears in the context of the dietary laws. So in Deuteronomy, it's in that section. But the other two sources indicate that its origin lies in the overall context of the festivals. So you even get different contexts here. Sarna continues, the juxtaposition of this rule with the law of the first fruits led Menachem ibn Saruk, 10th century, to interpret Gedi, that's kid or, you know, the baby, not as a kid of the goats, but as berries, This eccentric explanation was taken up by Menachem ben Solomon in the 12th century, who took mother's milk to be figurative for the juice of the bud that contains the berry. You see, I threw that in because people are really going to great lengths to try to make sense of this. In another paragraph, there are other rabbinic interpreters, and he gives a list. He says that who in various ways adduce a humanitarian motivation akin to that cited earlier in Exodus 22:29. Rashbam further suggests that because festivals were celebrated with feasts of meat. Again, so these are the Exodus contexts here, the festivals. And because goats are generally multiparous and have a high yield of milk, it was customary to slaughter one of the kids of a fresh litter and to cook it in its mother's milk. Now, this is just rabbinic opinion here. There's nothing factual here to nail this with. Sarnar continues, the Torah looks upon such a practice as exhibiting insensitivity to the animal's feelings. The explanation of Rashbam has been buttressed by the modern observation that in biblical times, goats were far more plentiful than sheep in the land of Israel and were the main source of milk. The flesh of the young kid is more tender and more delicate in flavor than the lamb. Also, since the estrus cycle of goats occurs during the summer months and parturition takes place in the rainy season, the earliest litter would be produced just around the time of Sukkot. This injunction, therefore, regulates the festivities at the festival of the ingathering of the harvest. The interdiction of boiling a kid in its mother's milk was generalized to outlaw the mixing of all meat and milk. This is why in observant Jews, they don't mix those two things, meaning all dairy products when the reference is milk. So he says this is the law is there to regulate this practice at the festival specifically, but he includes through Rashbam and others this notion of, you know, compassion or humanitarian motivation. Now, Tige, in his Deuteronomy commentary, writes this about the Deuteronomy passage. The point of this prohibition is that the animal's own mother's milk may not be used. It is similar to the rules against slaughtering cattle on the same day as their young and capturing a mother bird along with her fledglings or her eggs, and the requirement that newborn cattle remain with their mothers at least a week before they may be sacrificed. All of these rules have the humanitarian aim of preventing acts of insensitivity against animals. It is likely, therefore, that the present rule also applied to lambs and calves, and that kids are mentioned only because goats were the most commonly owned type of cattle, or because their meat is most in need of tenderizing and flavoring. So that's where Tige is at, and he goes on to discuss, again, rabbinic opinion about this or that, but that gives you, you know, sort of the both trajectories there. There's a humanitarian trajectory, and then there's this regulation of what happens at the feast. Now, Tige gets into this thing about its association with paganism, which is what you'll hear a lot, you know, if this is ever preached, you'll hear a lot. Tige writes, Maimonides reasoned that since this prohibition is mentioned twice in Exodus, right after the pilgrimage festivals, boiling a kid in milk was probably a rite practiced at pagan festival and prohibited for that reason. This is not a sufficient explanation, Tige writes, since the Torah does not oppose all pagan forms of worship. Even sacrifice and prayer were practiced by pagans. Let me stop there. What he's saying is that, hey, pagans prayed. They offered sacrifices. So if just because a pagan did it was a reason to prohibit it, prayer and sacrifice would be prohibited too. Instead, you know, just cutting to the chase here, instead, you know, Tige would say, well, they're modified. You know, it depends who you pray to. It depends, you know, who you sacrifice to. But the practice itself, those practices are not outlawed just because, and, you know, pagans do them too. So this is his point. It's not sufficient to say, well, the pagans, you know, offered, you know, they boiled the, you know, little baby goats in their mother's milk. And so that's why it's prohibited. Well, pagans did other things that just get modified in some form. And not outright banned. So he doesn't find this trajectory very, very coherent. So I wanted to throw that in because, again, you'll hear that perspective. Now, there's obviously more trajectories here that we could get into, but, you know, for the sake of this episode and time, I'm just going to leave it at that.
Jason from Ohio's question is in reference to episode 280, Exodus 15, part 2. And It is, how far or at what point do we cross from exegesis into eisegesis when looking for symbolism in the Bible? Podcast 280 discussed how certain references to trees, wood, and mountains are likely associated with God, but Scripture also connects God to wind, water, and fire at various places. At what point is, say, the rod of Aaron simply a rod and not a symbol for the garden or for God himself? Is it when there's supernatural language involved that we can make the connection? Sometimes when listening to and reading biblical scholars, I'm reminded of my English lit classes where my professors asserted that everything, even very mundane things, were symbols for something else. But it is always the case that the author intended his audience to understand the language in that way. How do we know when we get carried away reading into the author's intent?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would certainly say that no, they're not always to be taken metaphorically or symbolically. The examples actually given don't really clarify, wind, water, and fire. Well, wind and water, why does God appear in the tempest, in a storm? Again, you can pick up a lot of the vocabulary in those passages back in the creation account. And so the whole point there would be, the link back to the God who brought order out of chaos. He is in control of the forces of nature because he's the creator. That doesn't mean that the wind and the water, it doesn't mean like the prophet's not getting splashed, or maybe he just sees it and isn't getting burned. It's not a fire that he can touch and be burned. It's not water that he can get splashed with. Maybe it's just something visual. And in that case, is God getting wet? I mean, we don't know because typically in those instances, God doesn't even have a body. So if you start asking questions like this and then you start realizing, okay, the terminology here, because I can look it up with a concordance, occurs in creation passages. Well, it's probably just designed to get us to think that this is the creator and he has mastery over creation, mastery over chaos. And so we ought to listen to him. That's a real simple path. But again, that doesn't mean that everywhere you see these things, we are supposed to abstract them. The real question is, would it make sense in the context to be learning these things about the figure in the maelstrom, in the storm? Does that make sense in the context that we're looking at, directly? Same thing with fire. Fire is often used for the presence of God because it's purifying, either the fiery coals or a fiery basin or fire flames, like Ezekiel 1, okay, where God, part of God's form is fire, and there's fire there in other contexts as well. So my take on this is that the metaphorical or symbolic reading ought to be on the table for all of them. And then you have to ask yourself, well, does it make sense in context, to go that direction or not? Or maybe it's a little bit of both. There's no like guidebook at the end of the Bible that really tells you how to parse this, but I would not be, categorical and say always it has to be, going down one direction. So there's no way often to be really conclusive when it comes to this. Biblical authors are like authors now. Even us, we might intend a double meaning or not. Now, in the case of like Aaron's rod or Moses, that whole situation that the questioner brought up, because this rod of Moses originated at the burning bush, that's where he gets the rod. And it was used as a source of miraculous control over creation. It seems that the biblical writer might want us to think of the creator and thus Eden or another tree at which Yahweh was associated, the tree of life. And you also have the fact that theophanies, these appearances of God prior to Exodus 3 often occur at or are connected to trees. And so when you take all that together, it lends support for the metaphorical, idea. By the way, if we say that Aaron's rod or Moses' rod, that the whole point of that is to make, people, consider, the God of the burning bush or the God of the tree of life or something like that, it's still a rod. I mean, it still exists. It's not like it's not real or it's not, or the event didn't happen. All those things are still in place. It's just how we sort of parse what's going on, why it's this description and not some other. So I like to put them all on the table and then just spend time thinking about it. And you might come out with one or two or more possibilities. But to me, that's the fun part of Bible study. There's just a lot to think about.
Trey in Palmdale, California was wondering why, when Mike was talking about hardening of Pharaoh's heart, why you didn't bring up Romans 9. Regardless of views on soteriology and all the other theological problems that people have,
Why wouldn't you bring up the verses that talk about the hardening of Pharaoh's heart according to what the New Testament says about it?
Yeah, probably because I was just focused on Exodus in my head at the time. But, you know, I have to confess, it's actually far from certain to me how much freight we should attach to God's use of Pharaoh in Romans 9. What I mean by that is just because God makes an example of Pharaoh, who played a role in his own hardening, should we then reason that God is working the same way with the lost whom he wants to redeem? I don't really see much of a desire on God's part to redeem Pharaoh. Frankly, I don't see any desire. It's time for Pharaoh to be judged. So the analogy, at least in some respects, I think breaks down. I think Paul's point is that God doesn't have to show mercy. But then Paul proceeds to try and convince readers that God is showing mercy to the Gentile and will show mercy to the Jew. Again, the Gentiles are part of that process. So I think the passage is often read through a damnation lens rather than a mercy lens. And so I question whether that's really the point. Is damnation really the point here? Or is the point, you know, God doesn't have to show mercy, but he does, and he's willing to, and he wants to. To me, that sounds a little bit more like what Paul is angling for in Romans 9. So I don't really know how much mileage we can get out of the Pharaoh case to make Paul's point.
All right. Keith, when he was in seminary, he had an Old Testament professor state that when pastors used the story of Jethro and Moses in Exodus 18 to justify delegating ministry, they are taking the passage out of context. He suggested that Moses made the wrong decision when he listened to Jethro. Our professor never told us why. He was the type to make bold claims like this to whet our appetite, to hit the library, and do the hard work of research ourselves. It has been over 10 years since I finished seminary, and I have never come across a scholar who teases out my professor's bold statement. To be fair to my professor, as a bivocational pastor with several other irons in the fire, I have not had time to do the research the way he would have liked. I was wondering if Dr. Heiser has come across this interpretation at any point in his research. The best I can theorize is that Moses' decision to follow Jethro's advice could be interpreted as the wrong decision because the idea did not come from Yahweh himself in this circumstance.
Well, no, I've never seen this before, and it really strikes me as odd because when I hear that Moses was wrong to delegate, or that we shouldn't use Exodus 18 as a justification for delegating ministry, what pops into my head is ministry therefore a dictatorship? Like, do we have pastors that everything that happens in the church, everything done, it has to go over their desk? You know, like, is it a sin to let someone else do something? It sounds kind of odd. Now, I have no idea if this fellow was saying that or implying that. I give him the benefit of the doubt. I wouldn't think so, but that's just what I hear, you know, that it's somehow wrong to delegate ministry. That's just what pops into my head. I suspect, though, that that Keith's guess at the end of the question might be on the right track, that the rationale for why he would say this might be just what he supposed, that, okay, you know, Yahweh didn't tell Moses to do this. And then on that basis, you can conclude that Moses shouldn't have. But I really can't think of any reason why that would make sense either. You know, Moses is never rebuked for the decision, nor are there failure stories that are traced back to the decision, back to Exodus 18. So I suspect that the professor just had the notion stuck in his head that unless a suggestion came from Yahweh, it couldn't be a good one or a right one. And I would disagree. You know, I'd ask for biblical evidence that it was the wrong thing to do. I don't really see anything there. I mean, Moses married Jethro's daughter. I'm betting Jethro had good things to say about that, and Yahweh says nothing about it. Again, we're not told Yahweh said, "Hey, go marry that girl." But I don't see any evidence that that was the wrong decision either. I mean, did Yahweh tell Moses to go to Midian? Again, we don't read that. Was that a bad decision? I mean, because he meets Yahweh there at the burning bush. But Yahweh didn't say, hey, you know, turn left here at the sagebrush or whatever. You know, I want to make sure. He doesn't direct him. I mean, we don't get any direct statement where Yahweh tells him which way to go. So, I mean, let's face it, in any biblical story, you know, you could come out with something where a character makes a decision and God isn't the one who told him to do that. But the decision in the story, there's nothing wrong with it. So I don't know why we'd have to pick at Exodus 18. It just, again, it really strikes me as odd. And again, I don't know the fellow. But again, what pops into my head is this someone who has such a view of ministry that there's a control problem here? And it may be. I don't know, because I just can't. I can't see any coherent rationale for rejecting the idea of delegation generally, or that Moses did something wrong here. It's really an odd hermeneutic. So yeah, I wouldn't assign any validity to it.
Okay. Isaiah from Baldwin, Missouri has our next question. And many years ago, Dr. Heiser did a lecture series on Gnosticism and the Da Vinci Code controversy. When he gets to the two powers in heaven theology, Mikes uses Exodus 34:5-8 as an example of a two powers event. He says that there are two ways to read the story of God walking before Moses. He even has someone come up and illustrate that one of the Yahweh figures could have been standing by Moses and proclaiming the name while the other Yahweh figure walked by Moses. I was curious to know if Mike had changed his mind about this passage, since he didn't mention any of this on the episode that dealt with Exodus 33 and 34.
Yeah, well, the short answer here is I didn't recall any of that. And I'd have to go back and watch the video to remember actually what I said. So obviously I'm not going to take a commercial break and go watch the lecture series on Gnosticism. I would just say it this way, you could read it the other way, but I'm going to land with the way I took it on the recent episode of the podcast. I mean, to me, that feels, satisfying as far as a good interpretation and context, and I'm content with it. So even though I can't quite remember what, I said, gosh, that's probably 12, 13 years ago. Yeah. I'm content with what we did on the episode of the podcast. Another short one.
Yeah. I also like, Mike, how people ask me, like, what did Mike say on the 34th January, 1917? Like, I'm some database of what right. You say. I can't remember.
Right.
Anything.
I got no idea. Was, yeah.
I get emails asking me, hey, when did Mike say this? I don't know. Google it. I'm not Mike's keeper, but I find that funny. Matthias has our last question, and he's noticed that Sarna is the scholar that you've quoted the most in the entire Exodus series. Is his commentary on Exodus the best one out there?
You know, it's fair to say it's my favorite. I think Carpenter's EEC, Evangelical Exegetical Commentary, is good. It's certainly more detailed. Enz's commentary is pretty good too. I like Sarna because, and generally I like the JPS Torah commentary series because, the volume on Leviticus, is still kind of what I'm going to say here. That Numbers, I think, maybe gets a little bit too detailed, but I like that set because by and large, it avoids technical jargon. It'll just give you, really important, relevant information, and it'll tell you why. It'll answer the why question, why the commentator is veering over here or there, without spending, a half a page or a page and a half on source critical discussion. I mean, in scholarly commentaries on any book, but especially the Torah, commentators just get lost in this because they feel, as academics, they feel that they've got to address source critical theories everywhere. And I just get tired of that. I just get tired of it. I want a commentary that deals with the text as we have received it. I don't care about the author's speculations as to where the text came from or how the text came together. If that is relevant for interpretation, okay, then it might be worth reading. But I would rather have a commentary that deals with the text as received with an eye toward, good, ancient Near Eastern background information, and a good bit of, you know, like literary discussion, which I think is real important for intertextuality. So JPS series does more of that well than other commentaries, again, that just seem to get lost in these nuts and bolts critical questions. So I really like Sarna's Exodus. I really like Tighe's commentary on Deuteronomy in the same series. We used the one on Leviticus. It's either by Milgram or Levine. I think it's Levine because they switch off Numbers and Leviticus in two different commentary series, so I always get them mixed up. But the other thing is you'll notice in the JPS series, if you have one, when they get into these really technical discussions, they will relegate that discussion to an appendix so it doesn't get in the way. So if you're interested in it, you can still get it. I think like TA's commentary is something like 40 excursies, 40 appendixes, but it makes his commentary so much more readable. But if you want to get into the weeds, you can. It just doesn't get in the way of reading about a particular passage. He'll do both. So yeah, I really like Sarna. There aren't that many commentaries on Exodus to begin with, but Sarna's has more detail than most, but it's still readable. It just doesn't distract you with lots of these other things.
All right, Mike, and just like that, that's it. No more Exodus at all. No more questions, no more chapters, no more verses, no more nothing. That's it. That's the final Exodus.
So what I hear is this was our Exodus from Exodus. Is exactly. That what you're saying?
This is the Exodus of the Exodus. It's been a year-long journey. I wonder how many podcasts. I ought to go back and add up. Maybe. Wouldn't it be fun if we had exactly 40 episodes of Exodus? I don't know.
All right. You go do that, and then if that's what it is, someone I'm sure will attribute some numerological meaning to that. And
hey, it's got to be close because you think we went over a year, and 52 weeks in a year, and in there we had other interviews, and Q and A's and stuff. So it might be right around 40. That'd be interesting.
We should have done that.
I should have planned to make that happen, but we're not that smart, Mike. We're just not that smart.
I know. That's true. We're not that smart. We're not that clever.
Well, don't forget, if you want to remember Exodus from the Naked Bible Podcast for eternity, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and get your swag. We've got t-shirts, stickers, notebooks. We got pillows. We got everything. So,
I've got a pillow behind me here. I got one from my office because now that I'm using this newfangled mic here, I have to lean forward. So I'm going to hold it up for the live stream. I got me a pillow.
Now I get to sit
on both of our faces, or at least my back does anyway. So.
Mike, there's something not right about that, but
I'm just leaning on your face.
Drina's recording you right now for Instagram, isn't she? So everybody.
Yeah, she is.
Go to Naked Bible.
I'm gonna lean back and give Trey some pain here. So, did you feel that?
I did. Isn't that crazy? What does that mean? Yeah, right. It's like voodoo. I don't know what that means, but I can't think of a better way to wrap up Exodus.
Like I said, it's our Exodus from Exodus.
There you go. All right, Mike. Well, hey,
finally,
appreciate you taking the journey to get us here in the end to the promised land. It's been a lot of work, I know. We appreciate everybody that sent in questions. We certainly appreciate you tackling our difficult questions. And we thank everybody for it. It's been awesome. So with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.